Welcome, music fans, to Lisa's Walk the Talk Show, where you'll get a sneak peek into stories and lives behind the authors, entertainers, and celebrities that you love to read about. Sit back, relax, and let Lisa and her guests entertain you. Now, here's your host, Lisa.
Lisa's Walk the Talk Show, and today I have with me author Mitchell Nevin, and he is the author of a book entitled Psychic Reprieve, Deception and Reality. How are you this morning?
Very good, and how are you?
Doing good. Did you guys get the snow last night?
Dust to dusting the snow, not too much. Spooner is here.
Well, we're good here, too. The road's a little slick this morning, but what a great way to start off our interview day today. Well, I spent a lot of time last night reading up on your book, Psychic Reprieve, and found it very interesting, and your characters very well created and believable, which is hard to do sometimes as a novelist. And I know this isn't your first book, but tell us a little bit about your background and how you came up with these characters.
Well, my background is that I spent parts of 3 decades in law enforcement. I was with the Milwaukee Police Department. I worked more or less the central city areas of the city on the north and south sides. And then I worked on a gang directed patrol mission, a vice suppression via a car, and then I was in the gang unit and the intelligence division. And kind of over the course of my career, I've obviously run across a lot of colorful characters, not just within law enforcement, but outside law enforcement. And what I try to do when I write my books is I try to incorporate some actual events and then design my characters around the actual events to present kind of a real-life outlook of what people can expect to see from a law enforcement perspective, and also in this book, from the cases of those who are prosecuted. What is it like to be prosecuted? What is it like to go through the system and view the system from the inside of the perpetrator? And these people in this book are very much nonviolent offenders. They're generally the people with the most personality that you have contact with, and that's why I chose these particular characters.
Very cool. Which one, how did you come up with, like, RC? I mean, and is it somebody, like, you've met off the street, do you think, or just kind of a...
Well, RC was a... And back in 1989, there was a case in Milwaukee that was very similar to the hazing prank that RC eventually was arrested for and prosecuted for in the book. And what I did is the case involved 3 African-American teenagers, all of whom had no criminal records. They're just basically pulling a prank. And I took that story and then kind of incorporated one of the characters into RC. None of the characters actually are a perfect fit, but I just picked him because of the baseball mantra and how a lot of people, when they go into college sports, they get involved in hazing. You're seeing an incident right now going on with the Miami Dolphins football team. There's abuses of, like, hazing abuses, allegations, and abuses of bullying. I think that happens a lot when you get into sports, too, because I did participate in high school sports, and where people kind of get roped into things that kind of get out of control. And that's kind of why I picked him for the story, the events that happened in Milwaukee, and then also some of the experiences I had when playing sports.
Well, I just like how his whole character, you know, I mean, from his background, and I don't want to be too much of a spoiler on, you know, the book, but tell us a little bit how he, a little bit of his beginning in life and what happened to his mom and how he develops into a character, if you can, without, we want people to read the book, because this is really a fascinating read, and you won't be able to put the book down once you get into it. I will tell you that, because I spent most of the night reading it, but go ahead. And tell us a little bit.
Sure. Well, R.C. is he grows up, he's a son of a single mother. He doesn't really know who his father is. When he's a young child, he remembers the police coming to his home when he was left by himself. His mother left and didn't come back. The police came into the house and found that there was hardly any food. There wasn't any lights on in the house. The only light they found was in the refrigerator. And so at that time, the police removed him, and they placed him into the custody of his grandparents, who more or less raised him. About the time he was a young teenager, when he entered high school, he began to have a lot of questions. Students were coming up to him asking him, why do you live with your grandparents? What happened to your mother and father? And so he began to question the whereabouts of his mother, and his grandparents eventually explained to him that his mother was a victim of a homicide, that she eventually, when she was a young woman. She took a turn for the worse and got involved with drugs and prostitution, and she came up murdered. She was a victim of a serial killer, and that they took him in and raised him, and that they don't really know who his father was, but they raised him as his own. And eventually his father, who played minor league baseball, kind of took R.C. under his wing and groomed him to become a baseball player, and his mother, who was a grade school teacher, made sure he continued his studies, so he's given a good foundation of life to his grandparents, and that is how eventually he became a very good baseball pitcher and got a college scholarship to Milwaukee State.
And how did you think of that? I mean, I know you said it's based off of some of the incidents, but, you know, the detail was so rich, and I mean, I found myself chuckling a little bit, like, again, I don't spoil the book, but when, you know, the details of the camera, the video camera, when he gets caught, or when he gets caught, it's just so lifelike and things that would, you know, probably really happen. And I think that's why I enjoyed your book, because it was so believable. And like I didn't like saying that, but it, you know, just it really can take you into the story. And so was that particular detail part of that story, or was that something that was just fictionalized?
Yes, in fact, in that incident, 1989 incident, when these three people placed a package outside a bus shelter as well, but it was right outside of a TV news station. And a gentleman saw the package and alerted the police. And what happened in that particular incident, too, they took the video camera back into their apartment and actually videotaped them watching the events and transpired in the news and complained about how they really screwed up and they got caught this time. And, of course, when the police went and investigated the incident, they found the video camera with their statements right on it while they're watching the news. And so I kind of drew that incident into them. So it is really lifelike because it actually did happen, although the character, like I said, R.C. is not based on one of those three people. I kind of drew him up as a composite character. But I think if you look into these college sports, college fraternities, college sports, even professional sports to a certain extent, a lot of these hazing pranks really do take place. And I think a lot of times they're very harmless, and sometimes they're a little bit over the top. When they go over the top and people get drawn in or injured, I think that's all of a sudden when they become exposed and we begin to see the veneer gets pulled back. We begin to see what's behind the scenes as far as these pranks go. And that's what I tried to show with that particular scene in the book.
And then you've got to elaborate a little bit on the canon here. You've got the sergeant.
Oh, sure. The other two characters I picked, I selected, one is a Chicago police sergeant. He's an Irish-American. His father was a captain in the Chicago Police Department and had retired. And he entered the Chicago PD. He got married and ended up getting divorced. His wife had a drinking problem. Eventually, he gets assigned to the organized crime unit in the Chicago PD. One of his fellow supervisors, person by the name of Bump Sutton, he's getting to retire. And so within a week of his retirement, this new Sergeant Gannon Burke comes to work within the OCD, the Organized Crime Department Division of the Chicago Police Department, and he tells him that one of the things that they do within the division is that when drug dealers recover cash, when police officers recover cash from drug dealers and there's no known owner, for example, it's in a vacant house or whatever, the police give it to the sergeant and he uses it to fund the annual banquet that's held around Christmas each year. And this fund eventually gets, every year gets, you know, between $20,000 and $30,000 in this fund, and the banquet costs about $25,000. And so Gannon Burke, he's got a tough time believing that this is sanctioned by the department, but he finds out as he goes through the transformation into this new position that actually the department brass winks and nods at the kind of light level of corruption. Well, this money is used to fund this banquet, but eventually he gets sucked into a corruption charge because what he realizes is that he can loan some of his money out to other officers who are in need of short-term loans and get high interest back. For example, if he loaned $100 out on Monday, he collects $120 on payday, and eventually he builds his fund up to almost $40,000 or $50,000, and he is giving grants to officers who are having financial difficulty. And eventually the FBI gets involved with them and makes an arrest and takes him down on corruption charges.
How true is that, though? I mean, I've heard stories, I'll leave it at that. I've heard stories of things like that do go on. But in your experience, that's pretty rare, isn't it?
Yes, my experience is in Milwaukee. We did have a couple officers, or one officer was actually convicted. There were three people there that did take some money that was planted by the FBI, and that officer was charged in federal court and was convicted. But in other areas, for example, in New York City, they had a similar operation where they had a pizza fund, and the pizza fund had about $50,000 of it that was developed by similar methods. And the FBI was involved there, too, and took a number of police officers down on corruption charges. I saw an interview with one of the officers involved, and they wanted him to become an informant and give information on their officers, and he said he would not do it. And he eventually was sentenced, I believe, to 5 or 6 years in prison. So this does go on in some bigger departments throughout the country. It's hard to believe that would go on because you have to believe if you were the person involved, you have to believe eventually you're going to get caught. You're going to get apprehended. Police departments have their own internal affairs divisions or professional standards divisions. And, you know, most departments are fairly strict enforcing their rules and regulations and bringing officers to task that are involved in criminal activity or misconduct.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, you know, cops, like anyone else, can have bad moments, I suppose, in their life, especially if they're going through, well, you take your leave there with Anna, you know, I mean, with his wife, and of course, you know, I can see where that's probably a, you know, real thing.
I'm kind of losing a little bit.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Better. Oh, I was just saying that, you know, with Gannon, you know, you've got a wife that wants to have a kid and start having kids and, you know, turns to her drinking. And, you know, how real is that in the police field? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the strains on marriages, like you know, mentioned in your book, are hard with the different work shifts and so forth. But give us an inside perspective of that. I mean, I don't know if you're married or have been married or what have you seen in your 30 years?
Well, I think it depends on the individual. I think if police work can work well if it's compatible with the relationship. If, for example, when I had young children, I would work the shift from 4 to midnight. My wife would work the shift. She would start about 7:30 in the morning, and then we'd actually meet halfway and exchange the kids on the way to work. So in a perspective from our relationship, granted our relationship, sometimes we didn't have a lot of time together on the nights I worked, but it was great for our kids because the children always had parents there 24 hours a day. There's never any child care involved. And then on my nights off, which would rotate, some nights you'd have off during the week and some nights on the weekends, I'd spend time together with my wife. I think the problem with a lot of the stress is more on the officers, where the officers, I worked a tremendous amount of overtime, pretty much by choice, when I was on the Milwaukee Police Department. And oftentimes you can work between, you know, 12 and 16 hours a day for 5 or 6 days straight. Now, that's been curtailed a little bit just because of the way the changes in the system have been made, but it can take a toll on its relationships because really your first day off or day and a half off, you're just exhausted, and you don't really want to participate much. You just want to withdraw and kind of relax. And while other people who haven't seen you in 4 or 5 days or 6 days, they want to be actively involved in your life. And I think that's the challenge that many officers deal with. As far as drinking, I think drinking is synonymous with being a fireman or a police officer. I think both occupations have a lot of camaraderie involved. In the Milwaukee Police Department, the vernacular for drinking is called bubbling. When we have a slow night, like it was Sunday night, we'd say, hey, do you want to go out and have a bubble tonight, have a couple of drinks before you go home? And so if you fall into that rut where it becomes a habit-forming thing, it can become dangerous because the stress of the occupation is so high, drinking can become a stress reliever. What really happens is some officers self-medicate instead of looking for help from, say, a psychologist or some other person, a support type of individual. They will self-medicate with alcohol, and oftentimes it causes a downward spiral, especially in larger cities. I'm in Milwaukee, in Chicago, in New York, probably even in the Twin Cities, the stress is unbelievable. You deal with a lot of unsavory people. Nobody's cooperative. Depending on what time of the day you work, almost everybody's intoxicated. And eventually, no matter what type of human being you are, when you start seeing people stabbed and people's throats slit and a lot of bad things, it takes an effect on the human psyche. And it depends how people deal with it. I chose to deal with it by physical activity. I coached sports for my kids' teams. I thought that was a way where I could have a kind of a get, expend the extra energy or stress that everybody has to deal with and throw away. And in the book, his wife obviously had a problem just dealing with that one particular issue. She wanted to have kids in the worst way, and she couldn't have them, even though Gannon was open to adoption, which, you know, might have been a beneficial thing for both the child and the family. It just became too overwhelming for her, and she apparently just turned to alcohol to kind of like relieve her stress, to self-medicate.
Yeah, I definitely like Gannon. I actually felt really bad for him.
Well, I think he portrays really, what I try to do is, I know a lot of officers, I have a contact with them from Chicago, and they're a great batch of guys, men and women down there are great officers. They deal with a lot of things. They use discretion very well. And so what I incorporated to him was what I incorporate into the typical average Chicago officer you run into. I try to incorporate that personality with him, both in the way he conducts himself, with his kind of language and his character, the vernacular that he uses, and his political connections. I think political connections in Chicago often trump a lot of things, and so I tried to bring him in with that, all those things, to bring him in as a character.
And I think the way you handled it, and once we're in the jail cell together and becoming friends, we haven't discussed your little identity thief friend yet, but you can give us a little history on him. But, I mean, just the way that you led them all together and the way he can relate on their levels, I thought was a very ingenious way to write the story, and it worked well, I thought. So yeah, tell us a little bit about Luigi.
Luigi Fabriano, he's a older, about 60-year-old identity thief, and what he does is that he's an expert at forging documents, and what he does is he begins to develop papers for undocumented workers so they can send money back, wire money back to Mexico. Anybody who's dealt in areas that are primarily Hispanic with a lot of undocumented workers realizes that a lot of the money they earn, they send back to Mexico to their families to support them. And to do this, you need documentation.